Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, a founder that is proven. You know, he's done it before. Right now he's on a rocket ship like you wouldn't believe, and we're going to be talking about it. But again, we're going to talk about all the good stuff. We're going to be talking from like what it was like to grow up in Silicon Valley. Also what it was like to meet Steve Wozniak in sixth grade. Imagine about this, you know, the co-founder of Apple. And then, you know, going through motions, you know, starting different companies. Going through exits and also financing cycles. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Bhavin Shah. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alejandro. Thank you for having me here. It's great to join you on this afternoon.
So originally born in India, but then you lived in Jakarta, and then at 3 years old, you came to the US. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up, you know, especially in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, no, you got that right. You know, came to the US pretty young. So unfortunately, no memories from India or Jakarta, but I really remember my growing up in the Valley. You know, it was unclear at that time, you know, how special Silicon Valley would become. And technology was around us. My dad was in technology. But what felt pretty normal to us now in retrospect looks pretty unusual. For example, you know, there was this very sketchy neighbor down the street who my mom would always say, don't talk to him, just walk past his house, don't stop. And he had a very messy garage and all this stuff. And once in a while, he would be outside, kind of hanging out. And my brother and I and our friends would chat with him, not telling our mom. And turns out he was an engineer at Atari. And he would give us little EEPROMs with chips that were beta versions of the Atari games. And he would say, hey, go plug this into your Atari at home and try this thing out and let me know what you think. And that was like kind of normal for us. We were, you know, getting bootleg early copies of these games. And it was just a really neat time to be exposed to all of that. I remember, you know, spending my evenings on the weekends, school nights going to Fry's Electronics, which was a popular store where you had, you know, lots of computer software and hardware. And I'd piece computers together, build computers, the Pentium. 386, you know, all the different versions, 486s, we'd put together. And that was sort of, you know, what we spent our time doing. I remember, you know, almost vividly, there was a day, I think I was in sixth grade or so, fifth grade maybe, and we were debating at the dinner table whether we should go with Prodigy or CompuServe, because to us, that was the future of the internet. You needed to decide AOL, CompuServe, or Prodigy. Otherwise, you were going to miss out. And little did we know, obviously, how big the internet would become. But you mentioned Steve Wozniak. I had the privilege when I was in sixth grade. The school had to select some student to go to lunch, or sorry, to go to breakfast with this entrepreneur. I didn't think too much about it. I didn't know who I was going to go have breakfast with. And sure enough, it was Steve Wozniak. And of course, I knew Apple at that time, but Apple was still, you know, it was, I think, pre-Macintosh, or maybe the Mac had just come out. But it was, you know, the Apple IIe, which we were using at school. So didn't quite recognize the significance of that breakfast. But, you know, you continue to bump into people. I remember, you know, Steve Jobs walked by my mom and I arguing one day in Palo Alto, and he made some comment like, moms are always right. And then he kept walking, and I was like, who's that? And who's butting in right now? And turn around, and sure enough, it was Steve Jobs walking by. So, you know, you have these run-ins. I think here, the serendipity has a lot to do with some of what makes this this area so special.
So I guess, hey, in that sense too, I mean, what do you think, how do you think shaped you and perhaps, you know, like your eagerness towards becoming an entrepreneur later on, you know, living in and being surrounded by all these incredible figures?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, because people ask me all the time, like, how do you take risks? How do you get comfortable with, you know, making these bets? And maybe I'm missing that gene that would normally help people, you know, from or hold people back from making certain choices due to the repercussions. But to your point, you know, I grew up in an environment where lots of people I was meeting were entrepreneurs. And where that was coming from is, you know, I'm of South Asian descent. And there were a lot of my father's friends who were coming to the Bay Area, coming to Silicon Valley. And they were starting these very now significant organizations that, you know, especially in the hardware space in the early eras or early innings. And so every time I'd meet, you know, one of my dad's friends or family friends, you know, we call them all uncles. So all the Indian parents, friends or aunties and uncles. And so you would sort of meet them and, oh, this uncle's starting this company. You know, this auntie works at this a young company that, you know, now is, you know, worldwide famous. So I think that it wasn't even really a question per se of in terms of is entrepreneurship a viable, you know, path one can take. However, I did have a little bit of stubbornness in my mindset, which was I did see a lot of people just wanting to be entrepreneurs because they grew up in Silicon Valley. Like it was sort of like, you got to do it. Like, you know, if you're in LA, you want to be an actor, actress, right? If you're in Tennessee, you want to, you know, be doing country music in Nashville. You know, there's all these places that are tied to certain industries and domains. But for me, I've always had this kind of belief that, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to really think about what is your unfair advantage. And if you don't have an unfair advantage, then, you know, you probably shouldn't be doing it. Now, living in Silicon Valley has its advantages, but I don't think that's significant enough to overcome some of the things that you have to solve for as an entrepreneur. But it definitely gave me the appetite to want to go and see if there was an opportunity that fit my interests, that fit my skill set, you know, as I got older.
So in your case, you know, you ended up going to UC San Diego, and then from there you went to Stanford to go to grad school there. But eventually what you did is you joined a toy company out of all things. And, you know, it's interesting because it sounds like you had the entrepreneurial drive already in you. So what do you think took you so long, you know, to really get going right away? And instead of doing that, you decided to join somebody else.
Yeah. You know, I think the Steve Jobs quote that, you know, you can't really make sense of things looking forward, but you can looking back to some extent and understand how they might have influenced you. Look, I think for me, what really got me interested in that category was at the time. So if you think about where I was, so at UC San Diego, I was there during the first beginnings of the dot-com boom, and I was a student. And so technology was very interesting. It was happening everywhere. But I got an opportunity to work with Dr. Sally Ride, who was the first female astronaut in space. And she had put together a program where basically students could take pictures of the Earth from a camera mounted on board the space shuttle. And I just was like, wow, this is super innovative. You can control a camera that's way up in the sky. And it was sort of having this secondary benefit of educating middle school students about, you know, earth sciences. So that was a project that, you know, I worked with her on for 3.5 years and really started to just find a lot of interest and love for this idea of using technology in education. Because obviously, internet was booming. People were using technology for everything. It was disrupting retail. It was disrupting, you know, every category of business. And so this was another form of kind of thinking about disruption, access, and, you know, availability in a way that was never achievable before. So that got me really excited about this intersection of education and tech. I then decided to come back up to the Bay Area and go to grad school. And, you know, Stanford just happened to have a program that combined those two. It was a little bit of computer science, a little bit of education. And then I mixed in a little bit of the B school with all of that. And it just kind of exposed me to a new category. And I think it's this intersection of different areas that you find a lot of entrepreneurial opportunity when you're bringing domains together, when you're thinking about things in an original way, right? When folks talk to me, and my son's now in high school, you know, about what to major in, I always say, you should double major in something so that you can see the world from different perspectives and maybe find a way to leverage those two perspectives into a unique advantage that you might have. So long story short, you know, go and I spent, you know, time at Stanford learning about this intersection. And then I met the founders of Leapfrog, which was a fledgling toy company at the time, I think about 70 employees, and joined them and started to work in various roles from product management to business development, and saw that company scale to about 1,200 employees, and the company went public in 2002 on the NYSE. And I think to your question, though, why not just start something right away? To my earlier point, I didn't have necessarily some insight or some advantage that I could bring to the table that I thought was durable. But I had some experience, I had some knowledge, and I also wanted to learn. You know, I think we end up learning as individuals throughout our lives, and it just felt like a really amazing opportunity that met my needs. Again, I'm not one of those individuals that, you know, I'm going to start a company because that's the thing I want to do. I want to start a company because I feel like I have a unique insight into the space or into the category. So, you know, with all that sort of, you know, being the backdrop, yeah, went and joined the company and, you know, saw what it takes to go from private to public, what it takes to sort of, you know, think about brand, what it takes to be, you know, really insanely focused on product quality, because the founders there just had a really, you know, deep passion, but also skill at building a really high quality organization.
So eventually, you know, the time comes to go at it, no, as an entrepreneur, and that is with a gaming company. I guess the experience here, you know, as they say, you know, you either succeed or you learn. And obviously it was not the outcome that you had desired or hoped for, but it was a good moment for you to really discover yourself and learn about yourself too. So talk to us about this chapter.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, it's a chapter that I don't shy away from, but it is a chapter to your point in which I learned a lot about what it takes to build a successful company, what to do, what not to do now, looking back. It also taught me a lot about myself, what I'm good at, what I'm not good at. You know, you learn things the first time you're building a company, the first time you're leading a larger team, the kinds of people you work well with. Who do you manage well? Who do you not manage well? Who lifts and who raises the bar in the way that you need it raised? How do you raise the bar for others? And then how do you think about culture? How do you think about hiring? How do you think about capital raising? How do you think about investors? How do you think about all the different facets that go into building an organization? And, you know, luckily I was in my late 20s. I saw a lot of things early in my career that I could then, you know, really take forward and learn from. Most entrepreneurs, as you know, from this podcast and other work you've done, you know, it takes a few tries to get to a place that people you know, respect and admire the work you're doing. These things, like everything else, does take practice, does take experience to do, and does take time. So I think that, you know, from that perspective, learned a lot. Learned also that, you know, sometimes all your best ideas don't work out the way you intend them to be. And we started the company on the basis of being an educational gaming company focused on the large format MMORPG, specifically, you know, for younger kids. And then found out that that wasn't going to be very, very fruitful. And we didn't have the kind of, you know, early wins that, you know, some other products in that space did. And so as a result, we ended up converting the company into a more of a developer shop that did work on behalf of other brands and licenses that we would build games for. So that turned into a very different kind of business, which, you know, was fine, but wasn't the thing that gave me a unique ability to do something special with.
Well, alluded to what you were saying earlier, obviously the more you swing the bat, the more chances you get to hit the ball, right? And always, you know, as an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And you went at it again, And that was definitely a moment where you were able to hit that ball, you know, and hit it well. So talk to us about how Refresh, you know, comes knocking and how did that idea end up becoming, you know, quite a successful outcome.
Yeah, so it's a good point. And, you know, I think that when you wrap up one journey, you do a lot of self-reflection and you think about, you know, what you want to do next. And you make a good point. You know, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. It is hard to go and now work for someone else, to go and, you know, take direction if you've had time where you could sort of call all the shots. But not impossible. And I've seen people obviously do that successfully. I think in my case, Refresh was an opportunity that I had sort of experienced in real life. I had some previous journeys when I was at LeapFrog, where I was working with some world leaders on some sort of initiatives to help individuals in need, specifically in Afghanistan. And it's a long story, but what I discovered was that how do world leaders get prepared before meetings? And they had a paper dossier, and people would write stuff up and they would get briefed on who they were meeting, when they last met, what they talked about, you know, how to shake their hand, like everything down to the, you know, sort of every moment that they were going to spend, you know, what the person last asked them about in the last meeting, et cetera. So I was like, this is pretty interesting. And I wanted to create a digital version of that. And, you know, keep in mind in 2012, the world was all about these different social networks and databases. We were, you know, connecting through to all these different services. And that product made a lot of sense to sort of bring forth. And it was an interesting product. We had a lot of great users on the platform. And, you know, but also what sort of became clear is that product success was predicated on the cooperation and the openness of all of these data sources, because essentially you're sort of reading from those, you're making queries into those. And the world was evolving. The world was changing. People started to pull back on some of those systems and access. And, you know, people started to get concerned. And so it wasn't an idea that I recognized as one that was going to be all that enduring and all that, like, you know, durable, if you will. So, you know, the folks at LinkedIn had been paying attention to us, and they came knocking. And, you know, we kind of worked out an arrangement that made sense for both parties.
And obviously undisclosed amount. So we're going to have to leave everyone in the uncertainty as to what kind of outcome that was. But always, you know, an exit is a great exit. So I guess in that regard, you know, what have been some of those same, you know, takeaways when it comes to M&A? What should be the general philosophy, and what can you share with the founders listening?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, people recognize that entrepreneurship can be very rewarding. We also know that on average, most people won't succeed. But because of that dynamic, people sometimes get very fixated on that outcome. And the problem with that is companies are not sold, they're bought, which means that if you're out there and if someone even catches a bit that you're basically doing this for the purposes of some sort of an exit, it's not something that motivates the buyer necessarily to really partner up. Now, that's not true in all cases. And you have firms that specialize in helping companies get sold. And there's a lot of that work that goes on in M&A. And there's, you know, different perspectives when it comes to PE firms and how they go about choosing companies that they want to, you know, wholly own or you know, buy into and then run eventually. But I think when it comes to, you know, why you start a company and what you do with it every day and how you operate it and how you think about it, it really needs to be something that you believe you can give your very best to, irrespective of the outcome, irrespective of what comes to bear. Now, that journey, as you know, is long. And, you know, I was told, so we're about 8 years in, I'm sure we'll get into Moveworks a little bit, but I was told, hey, you know, to really do something significant in the professional world, you're probably going to spend at least 7 years building it. Now, it's not universal. It's not a, you know, that in some cases things happen much faster, but it does take that much time for a lot of people to build something of any significance. And then to really have an impact on how the world works how the world operates, to have an enduring impact, even beyond your own legacy, that takes at least 14 years, if not more. So I think that it's the requirement to stick with something long enough that then could lead to certain outcomes. But, you know, if you're thinking about that too much, I can tell you 7 years will feel like an eternity. And you sort of aren't going to set yourself up for success.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about MoveWorks, because obviously you are now 8 years plus in following that philosophy. So why MoveWorks? You know, you were now two companies in, you know, you had clear understanding on how to go about building and scaling and doing the whole thing. So why did you think that MoveWorks, you know, was a good enough of an idea, you know, to really take it seriously and take action on it?
Yeah, you know, Alejandro, I think is you probably know from all your interviews, I mean, the more you've done this, the more cynical you get. The more you, everything's a bad idea. People pitch me ideas all the time. Ah, that's going to fail for these reasons. That's not going to work for these reasons. And, you know, call it wisdom, but call it cynicism. Call it just simply, you know, seeing what the real world is, which is not a meritocracy. It's much more than that, right? Much more complicated. And so, you know, the MoveWorks story was one in which we were essentially doing a bunch of research into the world of enterprise. And having been in toys, having been in video games, having been in mobile productivity, I said to myself, look, I have the energy to do another company. So that was sort of the basis, right? I talked to my wife. It was like, you know, so what do you want to do now? And it was like, I want to go do one more company, but I want to do something that I can really sink my teeth into and do for the next 20 plus years, right? Switching industries can be fun. It's exciting at times, but it can also not leave you as deeply, as deep of an expert, you know, when you're done or as you're going through it. So I thought, hey, let's sink my teeth into something that I could really learn a lot and hopefully have big impacts. And AI to us was one of those areas that, really felt like it had a very long horizon in which we could operate. So that was the starting point. And then, of course, talking to CIOs, we were discovering more and more that there was very little use of AI, that a lot of the work that was being done inside the enterprise was still very manual, that was using, you know, very people-heavy. And this whole category that we got ourselves started in, which was transforming the help desk, was really based on this idea that, hey, if you could apply machine learning models, which my co-founder from Google and Facebook and other, you know, and other places came together with me to form this, we realized that if you could understand language, you could take an employee's request or question or issue, and you could pretty successfully solve it end to end by triggering workflows and doing certain actions. So it was that kind of realization that language was actually the problem, and that if you could get good at it, you could actually do the work of a lot of work for companies that today was very inefficient. It was taking 3 days on average to resolve a typical IT issue, even with the best-in-class workflow tools and systems of record. So we were in the era of instant. There was DoorDash, there was Uber. We're like, why does this stuff take so long? So that was the sort of genesis. And we started this company on the early days of Slack, because we also recognized that the secular shift of communication tools in the enterprise was also shifting. So we said, hey, AI was in a pretty interesting spot. We didn't know about the next phase, which, you know, obviously we're in now, but we said it was a pretty good spot. We had the secular shift of communications platforms like Slack and Teams emerging. And then you had the secular shift of mobile. You know, I started to see my parents use WhatsApp, and I was like, well, hold on. People like short form. People need to get work done, and they're doing it more prolifically in these platforms than ever. So maybe we can surface ourselves in a new way as a sort of, you know, bot / co-pilot in his early days. So that's really what kind of engendered it. It's, you know, perhaps not a made for Hollywood story where we're on the streets of Paris trying to hail a cab and getting frustrated, but it is a story in which I remember, just going and meeting, you know, a handful of CIOs, then meeting a dozen CIOs, then meeting 30 plus CIOs, and sort of making sure that what we were learning was a universal phenomenon. And once we had that conviction, we started the company.
So what ended up becoming the business model of Moveworks? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so we're an enterprise SaaS AI company. We have this agentic reasoner. It's called a Copilot that spans across the organization and talks to all the different systems of record, business systems, automation tools, and it allows employees to search and take action. So think of it as a generative AI co-pilot that's for all employees, for them to interoperate with all these different services and functions within their org. So we charge as a SaaS company in two ways. One, we have a per user license model based on the size of the organization, right? There's different pricing. And then we also have a consumption-based model, which customers can choose based on sort of active users. And, you know, what we find is that, you know, either one of those works for our customers. And it's an opportunity for us to keep driving more impact and more usage to be able to bring more capabilities to users. And a lot of it centers around this ability to do actions, update systems, you know, get you access to this, you know, manipulate this other record, update a purchase order, you know, find out who's the owner of a particular account. All of that stuff can now be done through our product, which drives productivity, but it also reduces the burden that companies face on the service desk, which is then how people think about the value proposition for what we do.
And here as well, I mean, you guys have raised quite a bit. I mean, you guys have raised over 300 million, 315 million to be precise. How has it been to the journey of going through the motions and through the different life cycles here, you know, to get this money in?
Yeah. Well, you know, as my co-founder likes to say, is when we started the company, we were using Stone Age machine learning. And these were statistical techniques, you know, ones that are named after trees and forests and things of that nature. And then in 2019, we were one of the early companies to deploy the BERT model in production. We started to use it for, you know, discriminative tasks. And as the transformer models became more and more prolific, we started to use them in our architecture. We never had a toolkit that you would build and design workflows. It was all done through this reasoning engine. And you asked about the capital, and where that comes into picture is we had invested a lot in a lot of very deep learning techniques. We have human annotation teams to help measure model performance, to fine tune models. And then, of course, as the world got even more interesting with GPT 3.5, and we were working with GPT 3 prior to ChatGPT coming out, we were working with GPT 2 even before that, we started to see the opportunity really expand. And no longer were we limited by a particular domain or a particular set of use cases with the older AI systems that we had built. But now we could actually go quite broad and wide. And so that's where we've actually invested a lot of R&D to build a truly agentic system, one in which people can leverage our platform to have a real conversation, to talk across a lot of different systems, and have it be just as fluid as ChatGPT, but also with no hallucinations, with real deep understanding of permissions and rules and logic that is required to be able to act and securely perform the tasks on behalf of the individual.
And obviously, you know, when it comes to raising money here, I mean, you had done this before, and you came from doing it, you know, going around the block a few times. So how did you guys go about selecting, you know, the right investors for this? And also how has it been to going through one round to the next? I mean, how has it been that experience as well?
Yeah, so it is a good question. And I think that capital raising is always an art. It's a thing that, requires an understanding of incentives, an understanding of individuals. I think what is the case, though, is people tend to invest in people they can trust, people who they have alignment with. And to your point, I have had experience, you know, raising capital in the past, which built some certain relationships and certain know-how that has allowed, you know, me to bring resources to this company. It is something in which I think I've learned a lot about who to pick, what kind of partners you want. Because I think one of the things that, at least the way I view company building, is it's a very precious endeavor. It's a very important endeavor. It is your life's work. Now, again, some people view these as very fast moving, you know, experiences. They build a company, a couple of years later, they sell it. But if you think about it as more of something you want to be running in 20, 30 years from now, the cap table does become quite important. And you think about who's on that cap table, who you've let in, who you've taken money from. While there's many sources of capital these days, I think having an awareness of who those individuals are, what you think about them, do you have vision lock with them, do you have the same philosophy as them, is really, really important. And so I had the fortune of working with a bunch of venture capitalists over the years, but specifically at Moveworks, you know, began that journey with Lightspeed, and their deep understanding of enterprise software was what really helped us think about building this business and understanding all the things that we needed to get right to be successful. And then Bain Capital Ventures came in, and then we had Kleiner Perkins and Iconic join, and so on and so forth. And we have other investors that, you know, continue to sort of provide value add. But these are all folks that I can call. These are all folks that I can, get advice from, who continue to be big supporters and who really understand this journey of what it takes to build an enduring company. One of our investors used to be a CEO of a public company, Enrique Salem, and that perspective really, really helps. You have folks like Mamoon at Kleiner, who've seen the best of the best and always has sage advice, or Arif from Lightspeed, really being a champion of this business from day one, but also having deep enterprise experience with a lot of his other investments. So a lot of guidance there and a lot of introductions and things of that nature. So look, I think I tell people, take it slow. Investors always tell me, hey, if you're doing a round, let us know. We can move really fast. And I'm like, I don't want to move really fast with a relationship that I can't get out of for the rest of my endeavor, right? I want a relationship that I can truly bet on and trust. And for that, it takes time. You got to get to know people. You got to do your homework on both sides.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, you know, like, they're banking on the vision, you know, and not only investors, but also employees, you know, customers. So when it comes to the vision, Bobby, let's say you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Moveworks is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah. So look, I think, your point about vision is right, but vision's easy to come by. In other words, like anyone could dream about going to Mars, but it takes actually execution that actually determines the winners and the losers, the ones who make it happen, the ones who don't. And I think that's something that we've been, you know, really indexed on. In fact, one of our operating principles is XP, execution quotient. How much can you just act versus try and debate or deliberate? Because you're always going to work in a sort of impartial, in a world in which you don't have all of the data, partial awareness of what the right answer might be. So, you know, when you talk about our vision and where we are headed, we came out with this platform, you know, as I said, starting in the support function, but has now become something that enterprises are now using across every department, from HR to procurement to finance to facilities to marketing to a variety of use cases that we bring out of the box, but also they're extending. And we're seeing the usage continue to increase quarter after quarter as more employees use this to navigate a particular thing that they're looking for, or to run a particular process, right? It's things that are common but are infrequent that tend to get people stuck. And they're like, wait, how do I do this? Or where can I find this? And they'll spend 20 minutes, you know, when instead our tool becomes this essential discovery engine. And the underlying plugin architecture gives us the ability to talk to all these systems. And the agentic reasoner gives us the ability to interoperate and to answer questions and to pull data from different systems. It's quite magical when you see it. And we're really excited about what it's now doing for us and doing for our customers. So when you think about like going to sleep, and this never happens, by the way, in the enterprise world. You have to grind out every new customer, new deal. But what you do find, what we do hope for, and we're seeing this already, is that we become this employee experience hub, this co-pilot that is independent, that is not biased based on, what system of record you have. These companies and organizations that have co-pilots for their systems of record don't make it easy to work with the competition. They don't work extra hard to make the competition's product work better with yours. But for us, we see everyone as someone that the organization, our customers, want to be able to feed into this experience. And so being that independent sort of facility capability that then companies can control really puts us at the center of the employee's journey throughout their day. And we become more of a Gen AI super app that people can go to and access lots of different systems. Now, it doesn't preclude, companies from having other co-pilots, right? GitHub is actually a customer of Moveworks, and they use, obviously, GitHub Copilot for engineering and code writing, but they also use Moveworks for all the other hubbers to be able to navigate the different services and search, tools that they have and documents and things of that nature, as well as take action. So I think that we're starting to see that emerge around the world. With 300 plus large enterprise on the platform and many millions of active users every day, every week, we're seeing kind of this vision kind of take place and take hold. But I would say that, the vision is easy for me to dream about, but it's the, as I said, years of work that it takes to refine this and to support your customers, to navigate with them this whole new world and make sure that you're, delivering a quality experience that they themselves can be excited about and rely on.
So let's say now, instead of thinking about the future, we think about the past, okay? Let's say I put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, maybe to that moment where you were about to give the notice at LeapFrog, maybe after that amazing journey, and you felt that it was time to venture into the unknown, into becoming an entrepreneur. Let's say you're able to stop that younger self and give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, well... That's an easy question, right? Because we can all look back and have this sort of perfect clarity. I think what I found is that I wish I had gotten into enterprise SaaS much earlier. I think this is a space that's really exciting, one in which there is a lot of reasoning behind what success takes or what it takes to be successful. I think, I was previously in the consumer world, and what's tough with that is you sort of never know for sure if the work you did that day is going to amount for much. Whereas in the enterprise world, the puzzle's in front of you. You just got to figure out how to put it together. So it is different, and one in which I think I've enjoyed every minute of it. I think the act of selling, the act of sort of figuring out this incredible puzzle that is the enterprise, was something that I think, again, going back, if I had sort of had the foresight, I would have gotten into. And some did, right? Salesforce started in 98 and Workday, I think 7 years later, and you know, a bunch of other, you know, great companies, Okta and others, really saw the early beginnings of that. But I think what it's now positioned, given the stage that we're in now, is there's a new generation of entirely AI-based enterprise app companies. And we get an opportunity to become one of those and build a company that I think the next wave of SaaS is going to be really predicated on.
Amazing. So, Bhavin, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Obviously, go to our website, moveworks.com, but you can go to LinkedIn and send me a note. Happy to chat.
Amazing. Well, it's enough. Well, Bhavin, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us today.
Thank you, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.